The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Welcome to this workshop, Transformative Teaching, the Paideia Model for an Integrated Christian Curriculum. You must like very dry and academic lectures here. I know you're punishing yourselves. Hopefully you'll stay awake through this. My name's Steve Turley. I teach Theology, Greek, and Rhetoric at Tall Oaks Classical School in Newcastle, Delaware. It's a pleasure to be here. It is hot and sticky, so I've chucked the coat, and I'm just going to wear my casual here. Just a few introductory remarks. There is a handout that'll help you follow this model, this diagram that I'm going to be putting up here. So if you don't have it, can you just raise your hand? I have some minions who can pass it out to. They haven't graduated yet, so they owe me. Where did my minions go? Oh, they're outside, yeah, taking a cigarette break. These guys, I tell you. So make sure you get that handout. That's going to help you as people are coming on in. We do have a handout. Just raise your hand if you haven't gotten it. It seems to me they're outside passing it out as people are coming along. Brilliant idea. So this will help you follow this talk. And by the way, can you hear me okay? Is this all right? Do we need to turn it up, down? We're good? It'll help you follow this talk. This is, I'm going to apologize up front. This is a very information-heavy discussion. It's going to bring in a lot of history. I love from what Pastor Wilson talked about earlier today that this has been done before. We don't have to rewrite the book. We can do it in new and exciting ways, but we do need to learn from the past in order to go forward. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive into this thing called Paideia. A lot of us have heard the term. We know it has something to do with culture, but we don't know the grammar of Paideia. We don't know its dialectic. We don't know how it necessarily fits together. What was its purpose? How did it work? How did it achieve its goals? What were its goals? This kind of stuff. And that's what we'll be going through in some pretty good detail and that keeps you awake. Secondly, what I'm calling the Paideia model is admittedly an abstraction. There were a number of Paideias in the Greco-Roman world. Really what this is doing is twofold. I do want to give you something of a conceptual model, a diagram, so that you can comprehend, again, the basic constituents of Paideia. And then, secondly, you can apply it. You can bring this model to bear on curriculum integration, which is what we're trying to do ultimately. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring us through the realm of Greco-Roman Paideia, primarily Greek Paideia, that eventually was picked up by the Romans. And then we're going to see the Christian development of it. That Greek Paideia will be the model that we'll see some of the Christian appropriations for it. The one caveat is in your outlines. It'll be a Roman numeral 4 in your booklets, and it'll say application. I just decided to, you know, just strew application throughout rather than have a set thing. It's going to be the application will be primarily in the Christian appropriation, unless you want to make good Greeks. the Greek, the first section is really to help us to understand what Paideia was and its projects that informed the church and its in its own formative period, particularly in the 4th century AD. So what we'll do is we'll go through the Greek development, look at the Christian appropriation, and then if we have time, it's going to be very information dense. If we have time, we could throw out some Q&A. But if we don't, or even if we don't get to your questions, I invite you to the panel discussion today. I think it's at 3 on the Paideia of God as curriculum integration, basis for curriculum integration. And you can ask it there, and we can flesh it out together. And then lastly, I think it's important to note that when I'm talking about curriculum integration, I'm not talking about some kind of gimmick, some kind of technique, or some principle, or something akin to that. Curriculum integration is a microcosm of a larger social integration, indeed a cosmic integration that we need to get in our imaginations and pour out into the lives of our students. Otherwise, it becomes very superficial. Integration is itself a reflection of an integrated cosmos, an integrated world. And so it's making those connections that I think is very, very important to Paideia. So with that, let's dive into it. What is this Paideia stuff? In thinking through what the Paideia educational project, in fact, was, I think it's essential that we begin by appreciating the kind of world in which Paideia was forged. For the classical mind, the cosmos was very much imbued and brimming with divine life. This is a fundamental difference between the way we as secular modernists view our world and the way the classical imagination perceived the world. We see the world as basically cause and effect processes, biological, chemical, physical processes that have no inherent meaning to them whatsoever, apart from that which individuals or cultures choose to project upon it. That was not the Greek worldview. The Greek worldview was that the world was filled with divine meaning and purpose. Plato goes so far as to say that the world is actually alive. It has a divine psyche, a soul to it. And this world imbued with divine significance provided the occasion for the formation of a particular kind of social orientation or inclination towards the cosmos, which classical scholars have called cosmic piety. For the Greek, there was this profound sense that one was truly human only to the extent that one lived in a harmonious relationship with the cosmos. Getting some feedback there. And this is because every person born into the world was born into a world of divine obligation. Because the world was filled with meaning and purpose, we're born into a world where we are obliged to conform our lives in a particular kind of way, in a particular kind of order with the world. Again, a fundamental difference from how we view the world today. As good liberal Democrats, we don't, and I don't mean as a political party, I mean it as the philosophy. As good liberal Democrats, we believe in a world that has no intrinsic moral obligation apart from that which we choose to impose upon ourselves. You're a Christian, he's a Muslim, he's a secular, whatever. You all get to find your meaning for yourself. That is not, again, how the Greeks saw the world. That's not how anyone saw the world up to the Enlightenment. This idea is that because the world is filled with meaning and purpose, divine meaning and purpose, we're born into a world where we're supposed to, we're obligated to, conform our lives in a particular way to the world. Some scholars have called this cosmic sympathy, this idea that the world is governed not simply by biological, chemical, and physical causal laws, but also by a moral cause and effect. You see this throughout the historians of Herodotus, Thucydides. You see it most especially in Deuteronomy 28 and the blessings and the cursings in accordance with obedience and disobedience. Josephus, in his Antiquities, talks about Herod, King Herod losing a battle, and he accounts for that loss because of what Herod did to John the Baptist. So if you look at the connection, and this is just commonplace for Josephus, if you look at the cause and effect sequence there, the reason why Herod lost his battle was not because of demographic, economic, political, and sociological causes. That's when you go to Princeton, that's how you have to make your argument, right? The reason why he lost was because God was angry with him. It was a moral cause and effect. And this is something, again, as modernists, we've lost. We don't think this way anymore. Therefore, this cosmic sympathy entailed the fact that every person born into the world was born into a world of divine obligation to conform their lives to the moral order of the universe. And the faithful response to that moral obligation is what we're calling here cosmic piety. Now, at the heart of this cosmology is a micro-macro relationship between the individual human person and the larger universe. The individual human person is literally a microcosm, a mikros cosmos of the larger macrocosmic world. Empedocles in the 5th century is the first one not only to systematize the four elements of the cosmos, earth, air, fire, and water, but also the four humors of the body. And he argued that the humors play a role in the body analogous to that played by the elements in the world at large. And that goes pop through Greek medical theory, who practiced medicine in accordance with this micro-macro schema. Now, with the writings of Plato coming into the forefront in the 4th century, this relationship between the individual human person and the larger macrocosmic world was reconceptualized in terms of the cosmic values of truth, goodness, and beauty, aletheia, agathos, and kalos. For Plato, the human person was made up of a tripartite soul, logos, themos, and eros. Logos are rational capacities, themos are volitional, ethical capacities, eros are emotional, aesthetic capacities. And because we're a microcosm of the larger macrocosmic world, that means that the world itself must have comparable threefold soul-like qualities, which he called truth, goodness, and beauty. The terms were pretty well established by the time of Plato. Your upstanding citizen in the 5th century of Apollos would have been called kalos ke agathos, beautiful and good. They contracted into a term kalokagathia. But it's not until Plato that you draw out this extraordinary cosmic encounter between the human soul and this cosmic world. For Plato, truth, goodness, and beauty corresponds to comparable aspects of our soul. Truth corresponds to our rational capacities. Goodness corresponds to our ethical capacities. And beauty corresponds to our aesthetic and emotional capacities. And the idea here is that the true, the good, and the beautiful provide the cosmic model by which we can bring about a comparable harmony within our souls. And a key role of beauty is assigned to bringing about this harmony. For Plato, beauty was the loveliness, the delightfulness, the delectableness, the allure, the radiance of the true and the good that awakened within the human person an eros directed toward the true and the good. And so beauty, by its nature, is a physics. It draws the person toward the true and the good. This is why we tend to associate beauty with attraction. There is a gravitational pull that draws me somewhere. And for Plato, if it's true beauty, by definition, it's drawing me to the true and the good, the divine source of life. And because beauty communicates truth and goodness to the whole soul, bringing harmony to our rational, volitional, and aesthetic capacities, beauty always awakens virtue, or arete, wisdom, moderation, justice, courage, piety. And this obtains when the logos, themos, and eros reflect the balance and the harmony of the cosmos. And thus, Plato sees an inextricable link between virtue and a true knowledge of the world. Very important, because we have separated this. We believe as modernists solely in knowledge separated from virtue. A serial killer can know 2 + 2 = 4. You don't have to have virtue to have knowledge. And Plato would say, that's not true knowledge. So we're going to have to develop that in a bit. As to the question of how one encounters this cosmic truth, goodness, and beauty, the answer was the polis, the Greek city-state. The polis came to be seen as the integrative bridge between the micro human person in the macrocosmic world. And the cosmic significance of the city-state was most explicit in its temples, which were considered architectural models of the cosmos. Keep that in mind. We're going to see that come back. The important point here is that the city-state facilitated the space wherein people could live, people could learn to live in harmony with the gods and with their fellow man, and hence perpetuate the life of the world. And thus these cosmic and anthropological and civic frames of reference all converged into this idea of a cosmic koinonia, a cosmic communion. And this is where you get the whole idea of a cosmopolis, most evident in Plato's Republic. This idea that the cosmopolis, this cosmic city, conjoins and creates a harmony between the cosmos, the human soul, and society. So this value that the Greeks placed on cosmic communion, a harmonious relationship between gods and men that perpetuates the vital life processes that sustain the world, this gave rise to a very distinct educational project known as Paideia. Flourishing in the 4th century BC, the goal of Paideia was the formation of a particular kind of human that embodied a balanced soul concomitant with the order of the cosmos, which in turn entailed a balanced city life in the polis that perpetuates this cosmic koinonia, this cosmic communion, and thereby realizes human and social flourishing. So therefore, Werner Jaeger, who you'll hear, that name will keep coming up every time you talk about Paideia, although his work is getting a little dated. But in his first volume of his massive work entitled, three-volume series, entitled Paideia, he observes that the central integrating question for Greek curriculum was what type of education leads to virtue, arete. Of course, you heard Jenny's earlier presentation on classroom practices. This fits right in with that. What kind of education fosters those dispositions, inclinations, and orientations that harmonize with cosmic sympathy and thus enable human flourishing in a cosmic koinonia facilitated by the civic space of the polis? So I think here we have three basic fundamental principles for integration, curriculum integration, in accordance with this Paideia ideal. First, there is for the Greek an essential coherence to the cosmos, and thus there's a discernible harmony, structure, and design to the world. Secondly, the moral nature of the cosmos can be reproduced in microcosmic form in the human person through the cultivation of arete, or virtue, by encountering the true, the good, and the beautiful. And thirdly, this encounter is facilitated in the context of a distinctive social world, the civic life of the city-state. And so these constituents I see as foundational for the integrated project of Paideia, fostering a harmony between the cosmos, the human person, and society. So what did Paideia consist of? What was it made up of? Well, first and foremost, by the 4th century BC, sacred texts functioned as the foundation for Greek education and society, for they provided the authoritative exemplars of virtue. Now, for the Greeks, the text par excellence was Homer. Plato said Homer's the one who educated the Greeks. And then next in importance came Hesiod, who gave us the genealogies of the gods and the men. And then eventually, over time, this classical canon came to embrace all the major poets, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Euripides, Aristophanes. And the poets were seen as divinely inspired by the muses to reveal through the gift of mythos the nature of cosmic sympathy through the dramatic portrayal of matters of morality and virtue. Now, the virtues codified in the classical canon were taught to the student from two foundational vantage points, musiki and gymnostiki, which correspond to the soul and the body, respectively. The practice of gymnastics had two goals for the Greek. One, it was to cultivate a healthy body in accordance with the classical medical theory of the micro-macro schema. But secondly, it was there to cultivate the virtue of enkratia, or self-control, self-mastery, Paul draws from this in 1 Corinthians 9 when he says, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control, en kratevome. In fact, en krati is one of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians 5:23. Generally speaking, gymnastics involve wrestling, running, boxing. We were talking last night, and I thought, that'd be cool to bring back, boxing. Maybe teacher, student, boxing. After school. Battle training, and even dance, choros. We get the word choreography from it. But note here the significance for integration. Sports are not extracurricular. It's very important, it seems to me. Sports are not extracurricular. They're not idolatrous either. that's what we're wrestling with today. Yeah, I'm off, you know, I'm going to ninth grade and I want to go play football, so see, I'm going to go and play for the secular team. They're not idolatrous, but they are also not extracurricular. They are intrinsic to the development of a distinctive conception of the body and the soul. It's very important for Plato, who thought that a young man who was trained only in music was effeminate, and one who was trained only in wrestling was a brute. You ever notice why, I read an interesting article, why Russian male figure skaters aren't gay? Because they still connect those two. To be a man is to be refined in this Byzantine tradition. To be a man is to be one who can be cultivated in gentleness and excellence and be able to knock your head off if he needs to. So a ballet dancer in Russian culture is considered very masculine, whereas we've split those two apart. Either, you know, you're an arts guy or you're a jock, and we've created two pretty ugly things. Moving over to musiké, music for the Greeks was much broader than the way we use the term. It entailed anything inspired by the muses, so certainly music proper, but also reading, writing, arithmetic, poetry, history, mythology, science. So musiké and gnostiké are the two main ways of teaching the classical canon to the student, integrating soul and body. Now, while stressing the importance of gymnastiki, nevertheless, musiki is really the heart of paidutic learning. Musiki was made up of two aspects, the content of what was taught, which consisted of the gods and the heroes and the classical canon, and the form, what they called the lexis, the grammar in which the poetic material is brought to bear, I'm sorry, the manner, I should say, in which the poetic material is brought to bear on the student and his development. The form, the way in which the poetic material was taught to the students, was itself divided up into two branches. Mimesis, the branch of the student, and what I'm calling here exemplar, which is the branch of the teacher. In terms of mimesis, because the sacred texts were inspired by the muses through poetry and music, the way they were taught to the student was comparably poetic and musical. And this is where you get this concept of mimesis, or the Latin imitatio. Mimesis involved the students learning how to interpret the poet's tone or voice in order to present a dramatic performance of the text. Texts weren't supposed to be just read. They didn't even have reading indicators. Everything was uncial, all capital letters, no punctuation, no space. So it was basically, it was recorded recitation. And so just like a music notation, it was supposed to be performed. The student imitated the text through memorizing passages of poetry, interpreting and reciting the texts. And with the advent of progymnosmata in the 3rd century, the student performed his own exposition of virtuous themes such as courage, prudence, piety, and honor. And so here again, you have this very interesting integration into the curriculum. What is being taught corresponds to how it's being studied. What is being studied corresponds to how it's being studied. There's a message, medium, content, and form correspondence. The important thing here to stress as well, and I think this fits really well with the classroom liturgies, is that the stress on mimesis or imitation signifies that the virtues were more, they were more caught than taught. Very much like music instruction, imitation doesn't involve so much the impartation of disinterested knowledge or information, but it's rather a process of formation, particularly the formation of a particular kind of body. When we tell a child, don't pick your nose in public, we're not just simply imparting information, you see. We're training their body and their behavior. And hence, we're fostering the child's dispositions and inclinations to act a certain way in public. Both Plato and Aristotle were very much convinced of the habit-forming significance of imitation. Now, the key model for mimesis is what I'm calling here an exemplar, the teacher, the didaskalos, the erastes. And I think it's interesting here how the relationship between the teacher and the student is itself integrated. Classically, the relationship between student and teacher is a special kind of love. It's a special kind of friendship known as synousia. Technically, it's a term for the association between an older wise man and a younger boy. Now, it could be associated with homosexual relationships. It often was. Synousia, however, fundamentally referred to a special kind of friendship between a student and their teacher, wherein there's a status differentiation. Generally, our friends are our, our same status. I hang out with the boys, But here, you have this idea of somebody who's above me, and yet we develop this extraordinary affection for one another. It's illustrated beautifully in Charlotte's Web. Charlotte mentors Wilbur, and they develop a love for each other. But she's always high and above Wilbur. Wilbur can never quite get up to touch her. There is a discrepancy between their status, but nevertheless, there is a true love shared between them. And through this friendship, the teacher and student embody a communion that is a microcosm of the larger cosmic communion that is the ideal for Greek civic life. This is where I mean where I think Paideia draws in all kinds of integration. So the way the student is learning is concomitant with what he's learning, while being mentored by the teacher into the social life characteristic of the wider civic life. Now, with the curriculum proper, I think it's important not to, over-formalize the curriculum that was used. But if we take our lead from classical Athens, we find that education was organized according to three main elements normally taught in different establishments. First, you have the pedotrivis, who taught gymnastics and general athletic fitness. The kitharistis, it should have an S in there, kitharistis. Taught music and the works of the lyric poets. And the grammatistes taught reading, writing, arithmetic, as well as literature. So the child, about the age of six, was accompanied by an attendant, a pedagogos, and taken to an instructor to learn to write and say his letters. And then after having mastered the letters, the student would progress to learning the poets by heart. And this was done through copying the short passages from the classical canon, memorizing, reciting them orally. Simultaneously, students were schooled in music along with singing. Students would have learned instruments such as the lyre, the avlos, a wind reed instrument. And so in a typical day, a student might start with gymnastics, then proceed to the lyre school, and end with letters. But there was no set pattern. And under the influence of the sophists, there emerges a type of secondary education that stressed logic, rhetoric, and the basic sciences that would eventually be systematized into what we call the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy, cosmology. And the secondary education becomes normative during the Hellenistic period and the Roman era. So I think the important observation here is that curriculum is Greek society in microcosm, with each subject facilitating what was considered an indispensable constituent in Greek culture. Music training, for example, was considered to be a key process of socialization. Not only did the students participate in regular public music competitions, but the ordered chorus and the well-tuned lyre were both metaphors for a well-tuned, well-ordered city-state. Aristotle goes so far as to say that the state can't exist without a well-trained chorus. Hence, their practice of history, art, literature, music, mathematics, science, they were all means by which one could tangibly and palpably encounter the true, the good, and the beautiful, while simultaneously being initiated into the very culture that facilitates that encounter. Now, it's through this curriculum that the Greeks attempted to foster a particular kind of knowledge of the world. And the Greeks, when it came to knowledge, made a distinction between scientia and theoria. Scientia had to do with problem solving, right, that 2 + 2 = 4. But theoria was a deeper form of knowledge. Thea, derived from the word to see or to look, involves seeing the divine meaning, the purpose in all things, the truth, goodness, and beauty that brings unity to the diversity and hence accounts for a well-ordered universe. So theoria involved the form of knowledge that can account for the essential coherence of the cosmos, that can discern the harmony, structure, and design of the world. And because theoria enables the student to discern the true, the good, and the beautiful inherent in the cosmos, it in turn brings about a comparable harmony within the human soul. And this harmonized soul is the classical ideal of virtue, arete. And so this is where you get this concept of what some modern scholars have been calling virtue epistemology. A true knowledge of the world involves a virtuous soul, because a true knowledge of the world is a knowledge of a world imbued with truth, goodness, and beauty, which brings about a comparable balance between logos, themos, and eros in the human person. Thus, the kind of knowledge entailed in the Greek curriculum integrates the soul within itself and in harmony with the cosmos. And so what's the ultimate goal? Well, the ultimate goal is what the Greeks term morphosis, the transformation of the student into a particular kind of human person. Through morphosis, the heroism of the past can be embodied in the present, such that the virtues embedded in the cosmic order and codified in the classical canon became habitual within the student. The student's dispositions, inclinations, habits, orientations are harmonized with the moral order of the universe. And with the values of a society inscribed in the body of the student, he takes his place among the citizenship to live in harmony with the gods and his fellow men. And thus at the heart of this morphosis is a love, an eros for the city-state. So you have Thucydides recounting in a funeral oration to Pericles, who sees the love the teacher has for the student as a symbol for how Athenians should love Athens. Both Plato and Aristotle, for both in the well-governed soul, is for the purpose of a well-governed polis. The community is simply the individual writ large. And it was those educated in Paideia who effectively perpetuated a common culture, because they all read and performed the same texts. They communicated effectively with one another, with common allusions and maxims, a common language, expressions, quotes, mores, etiquette, constituting the core of political and legal life within the polis. And it was faithfully living out one's obligations toward the polis that one embodied a faithful cosmic piety. And so we have here a comprehensive integration model. We can see a coherent cosmos interconnected by a discernible harmony, structure, and design. The moral nature of the cosmos can be reproduced in microcosmic form in the human person through the cultivation of virtue by encountering the true, the good, and the beautiful. The civic life of the polis facilitates this encounter through the educational project of Paideia. Paideia integrates the body and the soul through musiki and gymnastiki, which together integrate the student and the teacher through imitation and example. The mimetic learning is applied to the various curricula, which produce an integrated form of knowledge called theoria, which by its nature integrates the soul into a harmonic relationship with the cosmos. In this cosmos-soul harmony, in turn integrates the student into the civic life of the polis in such a way that he lives in harmony with the gods and his fellow men, thereby practicing and perpetuating a faithful cosmic piety that sustains the life of the world. So these are the basic constituents, the frames of reference that make up classical Greco-Roman paideia. So now you can't say you don't know what paideia is anymore. Doesn't the National Education Association look pathetic right about now? Doesn't public education look utterly pathetic? We're evolving. Wow. Oh, that's my daughter. What she did. She put together this PowerPoint. I'll deal with her later. Now, as far as the Christian appropriation of paideia, Christians tap into this cosmic piety, but they also radically alter it. Christians certainly affirm that all people are born into a world of divine obligation. You got to get that. That's huge. Particularly in middle school, in upper school, that will be challenged. Who are you to impose your cultural values on me? Right? The world has no inherent meaning apart from the meaning I choose to give to it. Boy, that's Christian. Right? We are born into a world of divine obligation. However, they introduce something wholly new by transcribing this cosmic piety away from the gods and the planets and the celestial spheres and imputing it solely on Christ, the Logos, the new creation, in whom all things hold together and through whom God is revealed as the infinite fountain of Trinitarian love and delight. Along with this, there is a radical recalibration of the human person. Plato believed that the soul was eternal and was, in fact, trapped in this created material order. But with the advent of Christianity, the human soul was firmly fixed within the goodness of the created order and inextricably linked to the physical body. The soul is no more divine than is the creation, and thus there is no possibility of an eternally existing soul. Instead, the human person is recast in the image of God. And the way the Greek patristics develop this, which is very important for the development of paideia, is that they're reading this term image of God, ikon to theou, in light of the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And the phrase created in the image of God is rendered there kata ikona, according to the image of God. And that preposition kata is very pregnant. It has the significance of being created in accordance with something. We were created in accordance with this image. And of course, then the theologians asked, what image are we created in accordance with? And the patristics answered with Colossians 1:15, Christ is the image of the invisible God. And so we're created according to that image, the image being the eternal Logos through whom all things were made. So for the Greek patristics, our very creation entails a relationship not merely to God as creator, but also to God, to Christ as God incarnate, the image of the invisible God. And this is why, for the patristics, the incarnation is so important to the realization of our true humanity. When we're first created in paradise, we're created to discern and delight in creation as a reflection of the Logos through whom all things are made, and hence we're able to understand ourselves as creatures created in that image. But in the fall, this vision is frustrated. It's marred by the tyranny of sin, death, and the devil. And so the created order, the paradise that was to serve as the habitat that shaped and sanctified the human person, has now been restored in the incarnation of the Logos, the second person of the Trinity. Indeed, this is the classical significance of the Eucharistic meal, where the grain and fruit of the third day of creation, right, is transformed into the bread and wine identified with the body and blood of Christ, so that creation and communion come together to restore our communion with God and with one another. And so it's from these frames of reference that you have the development of distinctly Christian conceptions of truth, goodness, and beauty in both the Greek East and the Latin West. Now, the sacred space that facilitates this cosmic communion is the church, the ecclesia. Now, again, it's hard for us to appreciate the significance of that term, ecclesia. We just think of church. And if I recall, church comes from kirk, and kirk comes from the Greek kyriaki, which means Lord's Day, and it's just a contracted form. But the original church is called the ecclesia. And the Greek term ecclesia is not what we would call a religious term. I don't like that designation, but nonetheless. Ecclesia was, in fact, more of a political term that designated the assembly of adult citizen males who had the ultimate decision-making power in the polis, the city-state. And so we see, for example, in Galatians chapter 4, how the early Christian conception of the ecclesia translated into a new eschatological polis, what Paul calls the Jerusalem above, or in John's words in Revelation, the new Jerusalem. So in a manner comparable to the city-state, the church, the ecclesia, serves as a bridge between the individual person and the macrocosmic logos, reconstituting time and space around Christ in word and sacrament, and thus enabling us to fulfill our divine purpose and thereby become truly human. Now, the early Christian conception of the ecclesia as the new eschatological polis, the new Jerusalem, provided a natural foundry for the nurturing of a distinct Christian paideia. Obviously, you're now familiar today with the term paideia in Ephesians 6:4, where Paul exhorts his fathers to raise their children in the paideia to kiriou, the paideia of the Lord. What's interesting there, it's a completely unprecedented phrase. Notice Paul does not instruct fathers to raise their children in the paideia of the Greeks, or the paideia of the Romans, or even the paideia of the Jews. It's a paideia of the Lord. It's a paideia not of this world that's been revealed through Christ. It's cool, like apocalyptic kind of thing. And if this is the case, then given our paideia model, we can expect to see the emergence of a distinctively Christian classical canon. And of course, that's precisely what we see. And I do believe when you're talking about and teaching the history of the formation of scriptures, this is essential. This is hardly ever brought up in seminaries, unfortunately. They'll bring up Muratorian context or canons. They'll bring up Marcion. They'll bring, you know, all this sort of stuff. But they won't bring up this idea that in order to create Christian paideia, you must have a sacred canon. A patristic scholar, Frances Young, makes this very argument. She's made the argument that this is precisely how the scriptures were appropriate in the first centuries of the church. Young traces the process whereby Christian apologists and educators deliberately subordinate the sacred writings of the Greeks. They don't get rid of them. They subordinate Homer and Hesiod to the philosophical, chronological, and theological primacy of the sacred scriptures. And so when we look at the writings of the apologists in the second century and the schools that develop in the third century, Alexandria, Antioch, Caesarea, Edessa, they're all characterized by a classical curriculum that has been reoriented around the emergence of a new classical canon, namely the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. Now, when we surveyed paideutic learning among the Greeks, we found that the sacred texts were taught to the student in two distinct yet interrelated ways: musiki and gnostiki, which corresponded to the soul and body, respectively. The emerging Christian civilization was also very interested in training the body and the soul, but now with the incarnation as the model par excellence. And there are two ways in particular that have interested me, what I'm calling here the redemption of the senses and the formation of the moral imagination. Briefly, the redemption of the senses involves a redirecting or a retraining of the senses away from the carnal and the sensual and toward the eternally true, good, and beautiful, and thus prepares the body for its resurrection. Susan Ashbrook Harvey has done marvelous work in this area. I've done a little writing on this too, and Jenny Rollins' work on the classroom liturgy fits perfectly with this idea of redeeming the senses. And this is, by the way, huge when you're teaching upper school and they want to know, you know, what's wrong with Lady Gaga. We'll get into that. That's fine. In terms of the moral imagination, I borrow the term from the 18th century British statesman Edmund Burke. to denote specifically the integrative role of the imagination, which fits with what Pastor Wilson was saying earlier today. The imagination has been gifted to humans by God to perceive the divinely infused meaning of the cosmos, which provides an integrative moral map of the world by which we might live out our lives. Those who are familiar with Jamie Smith's latest work, Imagining the Kingdom, he gives a very detailed, theoretical, I think sometimes overly theoretical development of this. And the reason why I like this term moral imagination goes right back to that tradition of that distinction between scientia and theoria, these two kinds of knowledge. And you catch this beautifully, if I recall, the difference between scientia and theoria. It's Hans Christian Andersen's, the Snow Queen, when Kay is being kidnapped by the Snow Queen, and he wants to pray the Lord's Prayer, but all he can remember is his mathematical tables. That's the difference, you see, between scientia and theoria. You need both. I want my bridge builders to be very good at math, but I also want them standing next to me in church. They need each other, and they imply one another. The key distinctive to a Christian appropriation of mimesis is, of course, imitatio Christi. And we see a number of places in Paul's letters where he presents himself as an exemplar and exhorts, particularly the Corinthians, be imitators of me, mimite mu, as he imitates Christ. That's paideia language. Okay. And so what I see is the heart of such Christological integration for us is a daily mimetic reinforcement of the characteristic Christian virtue of self-giving love. I'm very happy Paul Tripp's here. He's going to give a great, I've heard this Culture of Grace talk, lectures that he's given, and it's just wonderful, and I think that this fits right in with the whole idea of mimesis. Students and teachers striving together to live out the cross in their daily lives by considering the needs of others as more important than their own, cultivating humility, gentleness, self-sacrifice, both going to the cross in need of forgiveness and reconciliation, trusting all of our needs to God so that we love God, love neighbor, and thus fulfill the law. In terms of the curriculum used in Christian education, it was eventually more or less formalized, particularly in the medieval university curriculum, and what we call today the seven liberal arts tradition comprised of the trivium and the quadrivium. I do want to highlight a couple of recent studies that have come out that have been very, very helpful to me in thinking through the trivium and quadrivium. The first is a study that was just recently published by Classical Academic Press, written by Kevin Clark and Ravi Jain, entitled The Liberal Arts Tradition. It's an excellent resource. I'm hoping they've got a booth out there.
They do.
I heard that they do. Ravi, that is you out there, isn't it?
This is awesome,
Steve. You owe me, brother. I want a little kickback on the 10%, man. Oh, thanks, bro. I can't highlight enough. The little nugget I would take away is that both Ravi and Kevin point out that these are not these seven liberal arts are not subjects per se, but rather seven tools or modes by which knowledge was justified. The other two studies are both by Stratford Caldicott. Beauty in the Word, which is his exposition of the trivium, and Beauty for Truth's Sake, which is his exposition of the quadrivium. And what Caldicott does so well is he demonstrates how the trivium and the quadrivium function as extensions of the incarnation of the Logos. The word of the trivium becomes flesh in the quadrivium, and you get some of that in Ravi and Kevin's work as well. And given our paideia model, the primary ways in which I'm a highly trained professional. I can handle. So while grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric can be applied to any subject, the trivium coalesced fundamentally around the reading of texts. again, fits in with what we just heard this morning. For example, Latin and Greek were not learned in the abstract. They were learned in order to access classical literature. And I would add classical liturgy, hymns. And the literature itself is interconnected by virtue of a literary mimesis. In other words, great works of literature achieve their status largely by virtue of the profound ways in which they represent the grand themes and motifs of the classical canon. In our case, the sacred scriptures, which is a new and imaginative complexion. I was listening to a Ken Myers lecture on the way over here, and the guest, I can't remember who it was, said it beautifully. What makes Bach Bach, or what makes great literature, is that it resists time. Time, you hear the Lady Gaga song, and you're like, cool, neat, and you twerk, and you do all that weird stuff. But then over a course of a couple of months, it just doesn't do it for you anymore. And by the way, it's not supposed to. It's supposed to go fade out so that you can get a new album and do new things. And whereas with Bach, or great literature, art, music, poetry, drama, every time we encounter them, we're finding something new. Every time we're encountering them, they're awakening something within us that we did not know beforehand. We're seeing something within the art and seeing something within us over and over and again, and hence it's a foretaste of eternal life. You see? That's great art. It transforms. And so it's through the trivium that we train our students to see the world through stories, good stories, in the sense that all narratives point beyond themselves to a larger story. They're all microcosms of a larger narrative macrocosm. Fairy tales are wonderful to get students to begin to read a story as a micro story pointing to a larger macro story. Sleeping Beauty can be seen as a story about a Christ Redeemer who slays the dragon and rescues his betrothed by raising her to life. Pinocchio is a story of transfiguration, the Little Mermaid on the longing for eternal life. Vigen Guroian's book, Awakening the Moral Imagination, Teaching Virtues Through Fairy Tales, is just masterful at this. I couldn't recommend it more highly. As for the quadrivium, it's important to observe that arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy, they're not separate, but are inextricably related to each other in the quadrivium. Arithmetic deals with number. Geometry deals with number as it extends in space. Music as number extends in time. And astronomy as number extends in space and time. And this relation of these four aspects of numbers through the overarching idea of harmony, structure, and design as the central characteristic of the cosmos. And given our Paideia model, the primary way in which this cosmic harmony is fostered in the student is through music. Again, Robbie and Kevin do a wonderful job with this. Because music gives us it gives form to the moral order or objective value of the world. Good music, the better, as it were, music you're listening to, the more it is able to draw you into the divine life inherent in the world, as it were. Christian tradition taps into the Pythagorean conception of the music of the spheres, where the entire cosmos is subject to the same laws of proportion that rule music. And so sacred music in the church sought to reproduce on earth the music of the heavens in order to transform us into heavenly beings. In fact, inspired by this tradition, Kepler translated the ratios from his discovery of the elliptical movement of the planets into a music theory that was to later influence another Lutheran, one Johann Sebastian Bach. So for you science teachers out there, if you're teaching Kepler, make sure your students get to hear Kepler's universe in the music of Bach. And so music is, in fact, an extraordinary integrative tool, not only in the way it integrates number, cosmology, and time, but also as it integrates the affections of the student with the moral order of the world. I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis, the opening of Lewis's Abolition of Man, if you've read that through, and if you haven't, you need to, where the whole argument of the book is that the world calls forth right affections. There are affections that are that line up with the nature of things. So when you see a waterfall, you have the right to say, this is sublime, as opposed to, it's just pretty. That's not the right emotion for the grandeur of a waterfall. We're living in a divine arena of glory. Visually speaking, geometry awakens into art, architecture, and even urban planning. Keith Lilly's study on medieval urban planning has highlighted the myriad of ways in which the city functioned as a map of Christian belief and meaning. For example, the walls that encircled the city represented the cosmos, while the four gates represented the four gospels, and they were put in a cruciform. And the orthogonal or straight layout of the streets, most streets before medieval cities were apparently curved. Medieval cities made it a goal to create these wonderful, we were just in Savannah yesterday, and Savannah has these beautiful laid out straight streets that intersect with each other, north, south, east, west, and hence create crosses, but also they're lived out parables of Isaiah 40, make crooked places straight, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Lilly does a wonderful job documenting writings about medieval cities from the sources. And then the architectural design of the cathedral at the center of the city sought to explicitly transform the world into a vision of new creation. So the circular dome represents heaven, the four corners of the floor plan represents the earth, particularly in Byzantine churches, the church would be a perfect square representing the Holy of Holies restored in the New Jerusalem. There were often four pillars that come from the dome down to the ground representing the four gospels and testifying that heaven has come down to earth in Christ. This is important, remember, because the cosmic significance of the city-state in the Greco-Roman world was most explicit in its temples that were models of the universe. So students, in seeing the way churches function, they're seeing themselves as part of a civilization of church and family and community. All right, finally, in terms of, in terms of the kind of knowledge that this curriculum seeks to cultivate, we can see the conception of theoria and virtue epistemology developing in terms of Christ as the basis of all knowledge. This is especially the case with Augustine and his distinction between scientia and sapientia, knowledge and wisdom, which for Augustine is a deeper knowledge. Scientia deals with knowledge of the temporal world, whereas sapientia deals with knowledge of the eternal world. And only by encountering the eternal world can the soul be truly human. But because of the fall, the soul is trapped in scientia, just simply temporal knowledge. And so the way to sapientia is opened up to us in Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, Colossians 2:3. And so a Christian theology of knowledge is inextricably linked to Christ in a life of prayer and contemplation. And so I think it's important to train our students to recognize that knowledge is not a disinterested rationality or empirical verifiability. Rather, our knowledge ultimately, by its nature, participates in the inner life of someone through whom all things were made, namely the logos, the ratio par excellence. And this means that each constituent in the trivium and the quadrivium should be a subsidiary means, an instrumental portal that enables the student to encounter a vision of Christ in such a way that's specific to that subject or that art. For example, the incarnation provides a beautiful paradigm for the study of science. On the one hand, given the micro-macro relationship in the Paideia model, the physical body of Christ can be seen as a microcosm of the biological, chemical, and physical processes that make up our world. I think it was Andrew Kern who spoke recently on how studying the sciences is ultimately about studying the biological, chemical, and physical processes by which God the Son was incarnated. But on the other hand, the incarnation restores us to the vision of the glory of God in creation. And so in the words of Jonathan Edwards, the study of science becomes the study of divine things. And so we need to teach our students to look up in the sky and, like Melito of Sardis, see a whole flock of birds flying above us with their wings stretched out and realize, wow, those are crosses. Melito says if they were to deny that cross, if they were to fold their wings, they would fall to the ground. But by testifying to the cross, they rise up into the heavens. And because they fly in a V formation, the cross expresses the victory of Christ over sin, death, and the devil. Athanasius argued that the only death Christ could have died was crucifixion, because it was the only form of execution that put the suffering victim into the form of victory. This is the fostering of a moral imagination. To see the world in terms of its interconnectedness, perceiving truth, goodness, and beauty that brings balance to the soul and transforms the affections in accordance with reality. Most every time you encounter somebody who says, "How do you know God exists?" They want you to give a reason from very disinterested, neutral, rational, empirical basis. But that's only the case if we're living in a disinterested, neutral, and meaningless world. Christianity answers with Christ. Christianity answers with knowledge itself being transfigured. Finally, this Christocentric life needs to be cultivated in a particular kind of space, and we're running out of time. So I'm just going to just summarize here. I did another talk on this, actually, a couple of years ago in Texas on education in incarnation, cultivating a Trinitarian culture in the schools. But I'm drawing from here the fraternity tradition in the later Roman period, where students would attend boarding schools in Athens, Alexandria, Antioch. And they would literally enter into a new life, complete with a new family, teachers and students, a new appearance, school uniforms, and a new code of behavior. And the whole goal was to get them to really love this stuff, to love their new identity in their uniforms, to love their friendship, to love their teachers. Because again, this is a microcosm of the kind of relationships that's going to mark the culture into which they're being initiated. So I think it's really essential, if we're talking about school uniforms, everything needs to be brought back to Christ. You know, why do we have rules? Well, we have rules not to stifle you. We have rules, as Chesterton said, to allow good things to run wild. All of our rules seek to set the space apart as sacred space so that you can contemplate the true, the good, and the beautiful and allow your faith to flourish. It's not there because I got a hang up with guys with long hair. It's not that. Even just the discipline. Discipline is related to the term discipleship. So kids are going to immediately say, "I'm being punished." No, you're being discipled. Getting caught is grace. Getting caught is grace. God didn't love you. He wouldn't have gotten you caught, as it were. You would keep going in your sin. Getting caught is grace. I borrowed that from Paul Tripp, by the way. So you'll probably hear it again. He didn't get it from me. And I think mimesis is huge, too, when you get all the culture questions. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with that? The tattoos come up, the hairstyles. Sexuality today, sexuality is just like everywhere in terms of these questions. What's the problem with this? What's the problem with that? And mimesis is very important because we're able to share with our students we're creatures, we're created, and therefore by nature we're imitators. And so the question is never whether you're going to imitate someone. The question is always, who are you imitating? Whom are you imitating? What are you imitating? Are you imitating a culture of grace that considers the needs of others as more important than your own? Or is it a culture of secular entitlement that says the self is sovereign and has no moral obligation apart from what one chooses for oneself? And finally, the goal in all of that, haven't I said finally like five times? The goal in all of this, what's the goal? The Apostle Paul, we heard it this morning, exhorts the Roman church, "Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed, metamorphoses, by the renewing of your minds, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect, or in Paidutic terms, true, good, and beautiful. Notice that this passage emphasizes the body and the mind, the senses and the imagination reoriented back toward God. And the transformation that we're really looking for in our students, I would argue, is a love for the church as the body of Christ, the shared life world that is a new civilization, or in Augustine's words, a republic, the city of God, that through word and sacrament witnesses to the entire world that the totality of the cosmos has been incorporated into the transformative life, death, and resurrection of Christ. And so we have a comprehensive integration in the historic relationship between Ecclesia and Paideia. And with that, I think we'll bring it to a close. Thank you very much.